Hi, everybody. Welcome. So this is the American Spectator Educational Symposium coming to you from Palm Beach, Florida. The great Peter Schweizer is here with me. And so we're going to have three different talks here today, and you all will have a chance to comment online and ask questions online, and we'll take your questions. Altogether here, this is going to go for about 45 minutes. So it's about 1 o'clock right now, I think. So about till about 1:45 Eastern time. And we're also recording this. So not just for the live stream, but also for later on. So people can watch this. You can get a copy of it and you can send it to people. We got Jeremy here helping and Grace helping and our publisher, Melissa McKenzie over here in the background. And Peter's mom is here as well. So our biggest fan, his biggest fan. So we're talking about education. And so the two of us, we were going to hit the subject of the corruption of education, noting that you are an expert on corruption.
Yeah.
And his latest book, Blood Money. And by the way, our magazine for the American Spectator was focused, the most recent print edition, on education as well. And you can find that at our website. So if you go to our website, spectator.org, and just go up to the right corner, you'll actually see a little tab for this magazine. And it includes a list of recommended conservative colleges. And by the way, that's not a list of like 1,000 colleges, believe me, right? I mean, we're talking about a couple dozen. So, but to get started here, tell us a little bit about you. How many books have you done now?
I'm not quite sure. It's probably 23, 24, something like that. You and I have known each other for 30 years.
Right, right.
We both started writing at the same time, and you do a lot of essays. But I really started out in Cold War history, and as you did.
Yeah.
But then I started looking at corruption because I felt that there are a lot of things that are going on in the country. We have this ideological divide. But I think some of the reasons that bad things happen in Washington is corruption. There's a business model behind it. There's a self-enrichment component. And big government often is sort of the sidecar to corruption. Right. They work together.
Along with groups like the teachers unions, which we'll get to. But tell us about GAI. What does that stand for, and when did that start?
So it's a Government Accountability Institute. We actually had our March 1st was our founding date 12 years ago in 2012. And what we really wanted to do was focus on corruption and hold government accountable. So we are a collection of all kinds of researchers with different skills. We have a former Air Force pilot, fighter pilot, who works with us. And he always reminds me in the Air Force, this is what we call a target-rich environment when it comes to corruption. But we focus on a deep, in-depth reporting, the kind of work that used to be done by journalism, the kind of work that used to be done by academics, but is no longer done. And so we take the time and the care. We don't have timelines the way that you guys do, deadlines. We got to get to publication.
Sure.
So we can take a little bit longer, but we feel like it's a good supplement with organizations like the American Spectator because we need to have both.
Well, and there were groups like GAO. Right. The Government Accounting
Office. Yes.
Right. And the Congressional Budget Office that, in fact, when you and I first started in the 1990s in the think tank world, pretty much. You and I were both Hoover fellows for a while.
Yeah.
And we did a book together as Hoover fellows.
We absolutely
did. A book on Ronald Reagan. But they those groups back then did reliable work. I mean, pretty good work. I shouldn't say, because I don't know what they're doing now. I just haven't paid attention.
They don't seem to be engaged at the same level. And, you know, one of the first corruption books I did was Clinton Cash, which came out and was interested in sort of dissecting and understanding Clinton corruption. And, you know, I looked around. I mean, where did I go for the headwaters for the research? I went to the American Spectator, the work that Bob Terrell had done in the 1990s.
Oh, yes.
Nobody else was doing it.
Not
the major publications, none of the think tanks. So you find that a lot. And that's one of the reasons why I think having these parallel institutions, you know, conservative colleges as opposed to mainstream alternative publications, because the mainstream organizations are simply not doing it.
You know, since you mentioned that in the 1990s and Bob Terrell and the American Spectator, if you go back and look at those articles, and I have, because I've written a history of the American Spectator, it's not published yet. I need to get a publisher for it. But I went back and I read, and you and I read those in live time.
Oh,
right?
Absolutely.
We were in graduate school in the early 1990s, both of us. But those articles by, one of them was David Brock, was one of the writers before he moved to the left. But the other was Daniel Wattenberg.
Oh, yeah.
Who was the son of Ben Wattenberg. Then Byron York.
Yep.
Those were 5,000, 6,000 word articles.
Deeply and researched and reported.
That's right. And in fact, Bob Terrell did one on the MENA airport. I remember that. And they were substantive pieces. You don't see a lot of that in modern day journalism.
You see a lot of opinion. You see a lot of hot takes.
Yes, right.
I think a lot of journalists, particularly with the rise of cable television and social media, you see a lot of people who are more interested in getting attention by saying something outrageous.
Clicks, right?
Yeah, and the problem is, to me, that's kind of that's something that is a storm that kind of comes quickly and moves away quickly.
Right, right.
And what you need is the kind of thorough research that we try to do, that I know you certainly do, because that's longer lasting. And that Clinton research in the 90s is an example of that. If you think about it, it got a lot of attention. Then, in the 2000s, and for a while it was kind of it wasn't forgotten, but it was in the back burner.
Sure.
But then the Clintons came back on the stage with Hillary running for president, and it all got revived. And so I often believe I sort of stood on the shoulders of the American Spectator when I wrote Clinton Cash. We obviously added new material, but the foundation for understanding the Clinton business model was that original work being done by the Spectator in the 90s.
That's very interesting. And back then too, it wasn't just articles on like Troopergate and what the Arkansas State Troopers were doing, but there were real articles on Hillary Care.
Oh yeah.
With the travel office, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there was so much. When I went back and looked in the 1990s, everyone remembers a handful of articles.
Right.
There were dozens of them.
Yeah, there were.
And so Clinton Cash, let me go here too. So you and I first met, it was 1997, 1998.
Correct.
When I first got to Grove City College.
Mm-hmm.
And so this gets to the whole point of academia, right?
Yes.
Education.
Yes.
Here we go.
Yeah.
So I was, and I met you through Paul and Bonnie Schaefer. Paul was a colleague of mine at Grove City College. And at that point, you weren't the famous Peter Schweizer.
No.
You had done the book Victory,
right,
on Reagan's Cold War, which is an amazing book. I remember saying to you and Rochelle, saying at the time, like, I love that book. It's one of my favorite books. It's a real contribution. You're like, wow, thanks. Right.
Mm-hmm. But what did I tell you? Do you remember what I told you?
Oh, I do. Yeah. So I told him about an idea that I had to write a book on something that had to do with Reagan. I told you to do it, and you pointed to me and said, maybe you should write that one. And I thought, me? Write a book? Me? Right? So that...
And you did. It was the one about Reagan's faith and the role that it
got in Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, which was really a neglected area of understanding who Reagan was. I mean, I kind of touched on, people kind of touched on, you made it central, which is where it belongs. And that book really, I think, helped change the understanding of what motivated Reagan. The anti-communism was political, but it was also very much based on his faith.
Because people thought at that point, in fact, they said to me when the book came out, Reagan doesn't go to church, reads his horoscope. He was just trying to appeal to the Bible Belt.
Right.
But no, that changed it. And the book, The Crusader on Ronald Reagan.
Yep.
But I, in all honesty, so you really, that conversation to me was key. Yeah.
Well, you've done well, young man. Well,
so at that time, now you went to Oxford,
right?
Right, correct.
Right.
And where were you as an undergrad?
Undergraduate, I was at George Washington University. I graduated in '87. Had a couple of good professors, and there was the dominant liberalism, but it was not the progressivism that the campuses face today. And I think the institutions like GW have kind of squeezed it out. There was actually a conversation at George Washington University to say we should change the name because George Washington was a slaveholder.
While you were there?
No, this is later. I mean, when I was there, people still liked the brand George Washington. But no longer. And then I went to Oxford for graduate school, and the experience there was great. It's a different system, as you know. You don't take classes, you have exams. And I found it less PC than I found George Washington. But I think that's changed as well. And the problem is, as much as we want to try to reform these institutions now, I really honestly think we need to focus on, we need to continue to engage them and criticize them. It's really about creating parallel institutions and growing parallel institutions like Grove City College that I think is the wave of the future, because I don't think these institutions are redeemable.
Right. No, I think that's exactly right. In fact, there's a term among Christian colleges and Christian Catholic colleges about which colleges are salvageable mm-hmm. at this point, right? Which have the potential, some are just gone altogether.
Right.
I mean, and in fact, thinking in my area, Grove City College, and which is kind of historically associated with Presbyterian Church USA, mm-hmm. and then Franciscan University in Steubenville, which is about an hour and a half away. And those two schools in the 70s, 80s, and 90s found a way to keep on track, to go back to the faith.
Yeah.
Whereas a whole bunch of others during that period just left.
Yeah.
And they're not coming back.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty much done. Now when you were at GW then in the late 80s, how politically correct was it? What were you seeing political correctness at that time?
You were seeing some, but you know, this was at the part of the Cold War where, you know, Reagan's policies were really kicking in. The Soviet Union was trying to desperately reform to keep up with what Reagan had done. And the kind of the bloom was off the rose mm-hmm. with socialism. And so we went through that period in the, you know, from the late 80s to early 90s where, yeah, there were, you had the sort of the Marxist professor that taught comparative literature.
Sure. Right.
But he was kind of the crank,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. By the way, they're usually in English. They really are.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Right?
They're usually
right.
in writing departments.
Yeah. They're not,
economists, yeah, exactly right? That's right. Exactly right.
Right. Right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think back then it wasn't bad, but it's gotten progressively worse as, you know, as you have kids go through and experience what happens on campuses. You go there and lecture. I'm on the board of directors at Young America's Foundation. I know you're involved with them as well.
Great group.
You talk to students all the time. And the reality is it's gotten incredibly hostile in a way that I did not experience when I was in campus. It's a very, very, very different environment. I don't know if you've had that same experience.
Yeah, no, in the 80s, I mean, it was, everybody was pro-Reagan, right? I mean, by and large, so you still had liberals on campuses, you still had, you know, pro-communist marchers, but by and large, I mean, Reagan won 49 out of 50 states.
Well, and think about this.
84.
Who was the liberal? It was Walter Mondale. Mondale today would be an absolute centrist, or I mean, a lot of people would consider him a terribly right-wing white male.
Yes.
Compared to where it was. So the face of what you mean by liberalism or the left is, I think, has really changed.
Right, right. By the way, I'm sorry I'm sweating so much. Let me just acknowledge that for the room. So, but when I left Grove City yesterday, it was 19 degrees, and so I was just on the beach down here, and it's hot. So, but that's okay. But I'll be all right. So I'm not dying. I'm just sweating. But yeah, and I remember I should look up the date on this. Remember Dinesh D'Souza's article mm-hmm. for The Atlantic. And it was on political correctness.
I think it was like 1991, maybe?
Yeah, that's probably about
Does that
right.
sound right?
Yeah. That was a really big deal. That article was a big... He really nailed at that point the whole PC thing that was just developing. And Dinesh was at Dartmouth,
yes.
right?
Yep.
Along with Laura Ingraham about the same time. They were both with the Dartmouth Review.
Right.
So that was about the period, late 80s, early 1990s, I think, when it really started.
Yes, yes. And they started, I think, as a reaction to the Soviet Empire losing the Cold War.
Sure.
They realized the sort of overt political mechanism. So we need to further infiltrate colleges and universities. And we need to be intolerant because we can't win the debate of ideas in an open competition. So we need to shame people. So I think it became a cultural posture more than an actual set of beliefs. We're going to condemn you and shame you,
right.
Professor Ken Gore, for not going along with us.
Well, and remember too, and you and I both saw this developing. So speaking of YAF, Young America's Foundation, right? You're on the board there. I started giving a speech in the late 1990s. So I started teaching at Grove City College, Grove City, Pennsylvania, 1997. But I would get emails from students who would email YAF, because you and I were both YAF speakers.
Right,
right,
right.
And I would get emails from students saying, in fact, I don't know if we got emails yet at that point, but please come to our campus because we have Marxist professors on campus. And they're teaching that communism is good.
Mm-hmm.
Could you come give a lecture on why communism is bad?
Right.
And so at that point, we're about 10 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
collapse of the Soviet Union. And you and I were seeing it already.
Mm-hmm.
We're telling people they're not teaching these lessons about communism and the Cold War on modern campuses. So,
right.
I mean, if we don't wake up and start paying attention to this, socialism, even communism, are going to start to be popular on campuses.
Yeah, and also the revisionism. I mean, we all experienced and saw, you know, what Reagan did in terms of his strategy. You've written books about it. I've written books about it. You know, NSDD 75,
right.
Tear down this wall, all the elements. And generally speaking, I think the consensus was Reagan won the Cold War. Well, mm-hmm. 10 years later, because of their stranglehold on academia, it started to become, no, Reagan didn't really win the Cold War. Gorbachev won the Cold War because Gorbachev wanted to reform, which was complete and total garbage, not based on any history. And it shows the power of universities that history departments don't actually conform to what recent history teaches. They just put it in their own image.
Right. That's right. And cite themselves in their journal articles and don't do real research.
Right.
By the way, the reason that our books were so different, right? Mm-hmm. Victory, your book, and mm-hmm. my book, The Crusader, is you and I actually went and read the NSDDs, right? Tell them what an NSDD is.
Well, it's a National Security Decision Directive, and it was Reagan's sort of secret strategy that he laid out. And Bill Clark, you've also written about, really was foundational, and it changed the entire concept of Cold War policy. It was no longer containment, which is we're going to wait to see what the Soviets do and react. We're actually going to take an offensive approach, an offensive strategy. Like Reagan said, containment doesn't make sense. It's like playing football.
Right.
And when you finally get the ball, you punt on first down.
That's right. Yeah.
Bill Clark did not want to punt on first down.
No, he wanted to go on offense, rollback, a policy of rollback. And the point here is that these NSDDs, they did about 300 some in the Reagan mm-hmm. administration. Bill Clark, who was head of the NSC from 1982 to 83, did about 100. Richard Pipes wrote a couple of them, right? NSDD 66, 75.
Roger Robinson's
been with YAF for a long time. But the point is, he and I actually went and got these NSDDs at the Reagan Library. We filed FOIA requests, Freedom of Information Act requests, and we reported what they actually said. Academics weren't doing that research. Right.
They weren't. They were using their own theories. They were using Soviet literature. And you had the gall to actually quote from these documents, Paul, to say here's what the strategy is and how they laid it out.
Yeah. And we printed them in our books.
Exactly.
Right? Here it is redacted. Here's what it looks like. Take a look at it. Reagan actually said this.
Yeah. And that's when I think back then, maybe you were the same way. I was still naive enough at that age to think, well, they just don't have access to these materials.
Right,
they don't know how to get them. Once they become aware of them, they'll see what the actual policy was, and then you start to realize
they'll correct themselves.
Yeah, they're not interested in truth actually.
If you go to Congress, they have an archive called the Soviet Comintern Archives on Communist Party USA.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it is a treasure trove that just completely indicts Communist Party USA. Shows how all these people were working with the Soviets, right? And when I go there and sign out the documents, I'll look at who the last guy was who signed out the documents. It was me. Like 3 years ago.
Exactly.
So you have this massive cachet of all these amazing documents, and our academics aren't even looking at them.
Right.
They're not even looking at it.
Yeah.
You talk about corruption of academia.
Yeah. And you think about the original reason for tenure, the university was to provide protection for intellectual pursuits.
Yes.
To take the time. But that's
academic freedom.
Yeah, academic freedom. But it's predicated on the notion that the professor actually is interested in using logic and reason and history to understand events.
Right.
When you have ideological actors, they use the time that they have not to go to the archives and do what you would expect them to do, but to theorize and to spin these theories. So these, in a lot of cases, I think these academics are really agitators. Mm-hmm. I don't know why we keep calling them academics. And it's the corrupting process because the university administrators should be standing up to them and saying, this is not honest scholarship.
Right. That's right. That's right.
But they won't.
So the tenure protects the academic corruption.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. It locks the corruption into place, and the corruption is self-reinforcing. And the problem is, you think, especially at the Ivy League schools, I mean, what's the Harvard endowment now? $50 billion?
It's just unbelievable.
Yeah, and so they are reaching the point, if they haven't already, where even if they have people say, I'm not going to donate anymore, That's okay.
That's fine.
Yeah, we have enough income.
We'll use the money to heat the fireplace.
Yeah. We have enough income already to cover our costs from the endowment. We don't need your money.
By the way, Grove City College, my college, no tenure.
No tenure.
We don't have tenure. No, we've never had tenure. That's on 1 year contracts, including the president of the college. So that's issued by the board. He could lose his job. And let me say for the record, in a truly authentically Christian college environment, which mm-hmm. it is. they don't fire people unjustifiably.
Right.
Right. So, right. And also we'll have professors who don't get very high ratings among some of the students. We try to work with them,
right?
Help them, guide them. Right.
Yeah.
So we haven't, our professors haven't needed tenure because they're treated well to begin with. So if you just treat people with charity and decency, but instead tenure has become this way to, in many ways, protect academically corrupts, you know, corrupt in a scholarly way, scholarly malpractice, malfeasance, whatever word you want to use, some of these professors at other universities, but all of them, pretty much.
Well, and think about the corrupting process in this way as well. Grove City College, you do a lot of research and writing. You also teach.
Yeah, that's right.
At a lot of these universities, teaching actual students,
they don't do much of it.
They don't do much of it. It's done by grad students. It's tilted. So universities have become less about actually equipping young people for life intellectually, in terms of the way they approach with their mind. It's become more sort of these isolated wards,
right,
of ideological battles. So the corruption also relates to they're not serving students well. And I think that,
by the way, ideologically one-sided battles.
Oh, absolutely.
You mean like not ideological battles where people are genuinely contesting the battle of
ideas.
It's
all pointed one way.
It's all pointed one way.
Yeah.
So it's ideological left battling the rest of the world from their oasis there, their ward at the university.
Yeah. And I think this is one of the reasons you see a lot of students are no longer going to college anymore, right? They're graduating high school. They're realizing it doesn't make sense economically. And I think it's because of this corruptive process. So it's in a wonderful way, it's an example, I think, of the market working.
Yeah.
The the perceived value of a university degree, whether it's, you know, Harvard or whether it's a state university, is far less than it was. One of the reasons is because people have become aware of how corrupt these institutions are. They don't serve their students well. They're one-sided ideologically, and people are opting out. So I think it's a wonderful thing. We're going to actually see some colleges go out of business. They've been going out of business for a while.
They should.
And they should, because they're failing.
And they're also, they've also hit a demographic time bomb where there aren't as many students available to go there in the first place. And we should add here, young men in particular are opting out of college.
Yeah.
And we're already seeing now the majority of undergrads, far and away, are women.
Yeah.
And also
like
graduate
60, 40.
School.
It's like 60-40.
It's like 60-40, and also law school.
Yeah.
Also medical school. And by the way, they didn't need the Equal Rights Amendment to do this, right?
Right.
Government didn't have to force this. It happened naturally. Our Scott McKay, right, Melissa, has written about how this could create a cultural marriage problem of young conservative guys who want to do a trade or go to the military or be a plumber or start a business, and they go and they meet these young woke girls from the universities who've been indoctrinated and brainwashed by the universities.
Yeah.
And it's creating a problem, a compatibility problem between some of the guys and some of the girls.
Yeah. No, it's I hope that the market corrective helps with this corruption. Again, I don't think that these institutions are redeemable by themselves. And I think the corruption is so solidified and calcified as enrollments decline, as people opt no to college, they still don't realize why people are choosing to do that.
Right, right. Or they won't admit
it. Yeah, they won't admit it. They're so insular, or they won't admit
it. It's like the liberal mainline denomination that says,
if we could
just be more liberal, you know, if we could just do more of this and more of that, then they'll come back. Meanwhile, they're going to the big independent non-denominational mega churches. And, you know, we just haven't done enough of our liberal agenda here from the pulpit yet. And speaking of tenure, the first time that I found out that tenure even existed in K through 12, I was shocked.
Yeah.
And it was from a former college roommate of mine who had become a teacher. And he told me that he was up for tenure. And I said, you're up for tenure. And he said, yeah. And I said, well, do you have to like publish articles or something? Or and he said, no, I just have to teach. And I said, for how long? And he said, well, 2 to 3 years. And that was like 3 to 5. And I said, so you just at a certain point get tenure.
Right.
I said, yeah, I might have to go to a couple conferences every now and then. But and I said, what's the whole point of this?
Yeah.
And he looked at me and he was conservative. And he said, well, frankly, the whole point is to protect us via the teachers union with this added thing of tenure. So we can't be fired.
Yeah.
Unless we do something really egregiously wrong.
Yeah.
And that the egregiously wrong doesn't include poorly teaching the students.
Right. Right. So they used to call that the dance of the lemons, right? You get a bad teacher, and then the school district, bad teacher, they would move them to another school.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the bad teacher from that school would move to another school. So nobody ever got fired. They always had jobs.
Right.
They were just terrible teachers.
And in every single one of that particular teacher's classrooms, all the kids have attention deficit. They all have attention deficit disorder. And everyone was like, amazing. There's like 30 kids in this class with ADD. I'll tell you what's wrong with these kids. Yeah, riddling them up.
Yeah. Blame the students. Don't blame the teachers.
Blame the students. So how are we doing? Do we have any questions that you want to take? Anybody want to chime in?
A great point, and that is the teachers unions and the corruption, particularly that became more apparent to people during COVID, right? I mean, a lot of parents didn't really realize what was going on in their schools. And then you had the teachers unions who said, teachers aren't going to go back. You need to keep paying them. The teachers are not going to go back. Really did severe damage, as we know, to a lot of students, because what happened, of course, is they weren't in the class. They were plugged into something online, and academic performance went through the floor. But the teachers unions didn't care.
Right.
Because ultimately, the teachers unions are about the teachers. They're not about the students. And I think that's kind of that veil has been ripped off of the teachers union. And the question is, where do you go from here? And I think, you know, for some parents, obviously, the option is, you know, homeschooling.
Sure.
Now, some people, maybe you're a single parent home, maybe have, you know, you need both incomes. It's hard to kind of balance that depending on your situation. That's not always an option. But school choice has been growing in a lot of states. And you actually see a lot of politically liberal people. And that's, I think, a powerful tool against the corruption in education, whether it's higher education or secondary education, is competition. Higher, you know, education is now competing with trade schools, with other alternatives to simply getting a four-year degree. And I think at the secondary level, and this is why the left does not want this competition. This is why they poo-poo trade schools. This is why they poo-poo homeschooling, because they know if you actually have competition, they cannot win.
That's right. That's right. You know, in COVID too, I mean, we've homeschooled, I should say my wife has homeschooled. All right. She's done most of it. We have eight kids. So we've homeschooled eight kids, and you've done homeschooling too. Mm-hmm. You and Rochelle, your wife. And in fact, we'll talk about the kind of hybrid model we've both sort of done with that. But I met a lot of people during COVID who, when they had their kids home and the kids were learning, from their computer via Zoom or whatever else. I had parents who told me, you know, I sat there and actually watched what Johnny was being taught or not taught. Or also I saw how much time was wasted. And I thought, I could do this. Is this really that hard to do? Right. Now, there are probably other people who said couldn't handle having the kids at home and wanted to send them back to school right away.
Right. Right.
But I think there's no question that the homeschool movement expanded during COVID.
Yeah.
And also there's also the part of making the kids wear masks when they probably didn't need to, because kids that were young weren't really, you know, vulnerable in a bad way to COVID. But that led to, I think, more homeschooling.
The
COVID.
Absolutely. And I think it's healthy again. I mean, what did public schooling pitch us? Trust us with your kids. We'll take care of them. And for decades, that was kind of the bargain that was struck. Public schools were not perfect by any means, but they weren't as bad as they are today. And what this opportunity that COVID presented, of course, was a tragedy in a lot of ways, but it was beneficial in the sense that it brought the classroom home and the parents actually saw what was being taught and the waste that was being done. And I hear that all the time. My kids are all grown. They're all in their 20s. But I hear that all the time, parents that homeschool their kids do very, very well academically. And they say, you know, they were spending 5-6 hours at the school. And we can do that in 2.5-3 hours.
That's right.
You just focus and you don't have all the other, you know, stuff that goes along in public education. So that's really exciting. The fear always is, of course, that memory will be forgotten and that people will again start trusting these institutions.
Right, right.
But let's hope not. And, you know, the Spectator and GAI, we're going to keep reminding people, trying to remind people of what these institutions are like.
Did you go to public schools?
I did.
And I was a terrible student and I spent a lot of my day sleeping. in study hall.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I can go on and on about this. But part of it was I would have been a perfect kid to be homeschooled because I could not fall asleep at night before like 1 a.m. It's just the way I was wired.
Right.
And so there I was getting up to go to the bus station at 6 a.m.
Yeah.
And then I would go off to school and I would sleep a lot during the if I had been homeschooled on a different schedule. And by the way, for people saying, well, you need to learn to adapt to a schedule. Well, when you go to college, you get to choose what time you want your classes. That's right?
Exactly right.
You have to take 8 a.m. classes in college. Yeah.
And 17-year-olds, anybody who has a 17-year-old knows it's harder for them. They're still growing and developing. It's harder for them to adjust.
It is
the way that we do as adults.
In your mid-20s, you kind of learn, right? I learned with my first job
that
I had to be there and be there by 9 a.m. or I was going to get fired.
Yeah.
But when you're 13, 14 years old, it's not as easy.
Exactly right.
You have a question.
I'm going to let you take medical schools. I would just say to the question, I don't think higher education will learn. I think that certainly what happened recently with the Harvard president was encouraging, but I think that the leadership of Harvard will not be forgiven by the hard left for abandoning Claudine Gay. So it will not happen again. And again, I think these institutions have so much money. Yeah, people that went to Harvard in the 60s had a wonderful experience at the time. They die. They leave all their money to Harvard.
Yeah.
It's not the same Harvard that it was. And when you've got endowments this large, and let's also remember, by the way, these institutions of higher learning get billions of dollars in federal government contracts as well. Whether students come or not, Harvard is still going to generate an enormous amount of revenue. Teaching is kind of almost an afterthought. So I am not optimistic at all. I think even if you got a great president in at Harvard, it would just be impossible. It would be, you know, Trump fighting the deep state just in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Right, right. Yeah, we take no federal aid at all at Grove City College. We were the first to go completely no government aid at any level before Hillsdale.
Good for you.
In fact, 1984 court case, Grove City v. Bell is actually our court case. But let me say this, speaking to the cameras here, I run into this all the time. You do as well, where the alumni from these colleges, some of the most woke and DEI and left wing and, you know, in some cases, you know, pro-Marxist, pro-socialist, all of this stuff, just almost like reflexively leave their money to these colleges. And you'll have conservatives that will do this. And you're begging them, you're like, please, it's not the place it was when you graduated from there in 1950.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
If you want to do something good, leave your money to, you know, one of the 20 colleges in this list. Okay.
Yeah.
Leave it to, and also the Ivy League institutions that already get federal money, everything, they don't even need it.
Yeah.
They don't even need the money. So
they don't.
So be more wise about who you're going to leave your money to.
Yeah. I mean, I tell you, this would be, I just had this thought. This would be a great project for American Spectator or for GAI. I think there's also a lot of misinformation and lying and dishonesty by these fundraising offices at these universities.
Yes.
That Harvard and Yale, when they get an alumni who is, you know, let's say 83 years old, and they're deciding what they're going to do with their will.
Right.
They are absolutely misrepresenting going on in colleges and universities. Oh, yes, no. And they'll trot out, oh, yes, no, we have the College Republicans at Harvard.
Right. That's exactly what they do.
Oh, yes. And we have a Christian group at Harvard.
Right, right, right.
And to me, it would really be interesting to consider, if you did enough research, are there actually opportunities there to litigate for false advertising?
Right, right.
I mean, if you and I develop a vitamin supplement and we say you're going to lose 30 pounds and you're going to look like Arnold Schwarzenegger and it doesn't happen, you're going to get sued. And these universities probably should get sued because I think they're lying to the people that are raising money for.
Yeah, they'll say, hey, quick, put the crucifix back up in the classroom, right? Walk them through here. Yeah, we still have faith here, right? Right. In fact, our late friend B. Kenneth Simon from Pittsburgh, who was who the Simon Center at the Heritage Foundation is named for, he used to take the YAF list that was filled with examples of political correctness, and he would take it to his alma mater, and he would say, "You're teaching this stuff in your English classroom," and they say, "Well, but you graduated here, Ken, as an engineer,
right?
Why don't you give the money to the math program,
right?
Or we'll make sure, but the money is fungible;
exactly.
It just goes into the university, and then it cycles back in and." You know, and then you have the English professors at Carnegie Mellon in 2018 celebrating the 200th anniversary of the birth of Marx.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's just complete insanity.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's really what we need. And that's what I think great investigative journalism does. That's what the kind of research we do is, you've got to hold people accountable. They're not going to be held accountable. And how is it that there are all these investigations that a lot of them I agree with, of, you know, of corporate America, things that are being done in business, misrepresenting, Ponzi schemes, mm-hmm. but our institutions of higher learning still have this august reputation that they are engaging in things that are absolutely deceptive practices, fraudulent practices, that if you did, the SEC would be all over you in the private sector.
That's exactly right. Yeah. That's right. You get thrown in jail. Yeah. In fact, one of the things they do, what we call discounting, mm-hmm. and we don't do it at Grove City College, and we try to tell people that, but a lot of them will inflate their tuition price. Mm-hmm. So they'll say tuition here is $50,000, but in truth, they're going to give most of the students aid. Mm. All right. So they'll say to them, but you got a $25,000 scholarship, right? Because they already know what they can pay, what they can't pay.
Right.
And this really hurts us at Grove City College because our tuition is about $30,000.
Yeah.
So we'll tell them, well, we're going to give you $7,000.
Yeah.
Bring you down to $23,000. But this school is giving Johnny and Susie 25.
Right.
Yeah, but that school is misleading you.
Right.
They've inflated their, ours is an actual real discount. Oh, no, that's not, you're disrespecting. They do that all the time, too. It's,
yeah.
It's deceptive. And in fact, if they did in the private sector, they'd probably get thrown in jail.
Yeah. No, it's a great question. I mean, I guess to repeat it, I don't know if people heard, is what advice would we give to young people operating in this environment where on college campuses, you weren't supposed to be openly conservative, and now going into the workplace. What advice? I mean, you probably have this conversation.
Well,
with your students.
I tell them, be not afraid. Just go ahead and be who you are.
Yep.
We're both where we are because we said, heck with it. We're just going to be conservative, and that's the way it is. And we stood out for that too. And be smart, be intelligent about it, be careful about it. But also, when I did my dissertation, for example, I picked a non-ideological topic. I did mm-hmm. I did the role of the vice president in foreign policy, okay? So where I laid out what different vice presidents historically had done, Democrats and Republicans, it was a non-ideological, and that's okay.
Yeah.
I didn't have to do something on, why liberals are arrogant, right? I mean, I didn't pick a topic like that. So right. I picked a safe topic in order to get through, but I would never... if you get that professor who punishes you for your opinion or whatever, I'd challenge it. I'd take it to the dean. I'd take it to the department head.
Right.
And if you have to take your lumps and get a C or a D or take the class over from somebody else, you just have to do it. But be not afraid and stand for the truth.
I think that's great advice. And these people generally aren't used to being challenged.
No.
So I think if you challenge them sometime, they'll respect you for it. They're not going to agree with you, but they'll respect you for it.
A lot of times they do, to be fair.
Yeah.
I've had that many times where I've had professors say that have been charitable about it. You get some people that are just whacked out.
Yeah. And those people, you just got to, shake the dust off the sandals and move on and pick your life. And that's, I think, the thing to remember when you're younger, that first job or when you're in college, to realize this is going to be a very, very small segment of your life. And if you have character and integrity and conviction, you are going to sail through this, and you're a much larger person in that sense than you're going to encounter small people your entire life.
That's right.
That are either jealous or don't like what you stand for, what your views are. Don't be obnoxious. Don't be in people's faces. Be respectful and be kind as you should as a person. But recognize that you are going to encounter small people your entire life.
Right.
Don't look down at them, be bitter, but just move on.
And look at it as training and courage and conviction.
Yes.
Right.
Very well said.
And when you put your hand up in class to challenge the professor, do it in a kind way. I mean, as a conservative professor who acknowledges those biases, I like it when a student is kind about the question, right? And doesn't try to put you on the spot and make you look like an idiot, right? Ask the question in a nice way.
Yeah.
How are we doing on time? 2 minutes. Let me kind of wrap up with this. Charlie Kirk, Peter Thiel, some others, they've all talked about, I don't want to misrepresent, but there are some people out there that are generally telling young conservatives don't even go to college because the wokeness and everything else is so bad. I don't endorse that, but what do you think? What do you have to say about that?
Well, I think it depends on the person, but I think that, look, we've got great places like Grove City, like Hillsdale and others where you can go. You also have liberal colleges that are a little bit more tolerant. I think it really depends where you see yourself in life. And you don't necessarily know that when you're 18 or 19 years old. If you're doing it, I would argue, out of sort of an anti-intellectualism, they're all morons. I would advise against it, because you're going to have a ability to learn and absorb ideas in whatever career you go into.
Sure.
So I generally think that it's healthier for some people to do it. But overall, I would say, as a universal principle, no, I would not agree with that.
Yeah. I had a student who didn't want to go to college and was really forced to go there by his parents. And he really struggled that first year. And he went and started dropped out. Mm-hmm. And then he went and started his own air conditioning business and probably makes more money than me.
Right? And that's a great American story.
Right. That's exactly right. So you don't have to go. You don't have to go there. I would generally advise people to go if they feel that it's right for them, but you don't have to. All right. So wrapping up, I guess we just have a few seconds here. A plug for Young Americas Foundation, YAF.org, which we're both have been a part of for a long time. ISI, Intercollegiate Studies Institute.
Yep.
What else? Leadership Institute.
Leadership Institute does Gridwick. There are other organizations out there as well. There are local organizations, you know, young conservatives on college campuses, places like that. There are organizations like FIRE. What is it? Foundation for
Individual Rights and Education. Alliance for Defending Freedom.
Correct.
Yep. Oh, and here's a great point. Okay. How to stay conservative in college. One thing I would advise you to do right away when you get there, go to campus, find the Young Republicans group, find the pro-life group. They're mm-hmm. going to be with you. Mm-hmm. Find the Campus Crusade group or mm-hmm. the Newman Center, whoever. Find those groups right away and get networked with those groups. They will be your lifeline when you're battling against everybody else.
Yeah. These are people that are having the common experience that you are.
That's right.
You know, feeling not quite connected. And that bond is very, very powerful. We both had it when we were younger, and you will benefit from it too.
And courage begets courage.
Yes.
Right?
Absolutely.
And buy blood money and check out the latest issue of the American Spectator.
Yes.
All right. Thank you all very much for joining us. And if you like this, this will be posted permanently online, not just live stream. So get it and send it to people and share it. All right. Thanks so much. Spectator.org.